Hello, good evening, and you're very welcome to this special edition of Curtain Up. This programme is devoted to the work of an Irish writer called Seamus O'Kelly. Now, for those of you who don't know, last year we celebrated the centenary of the death of Seamus O'Kelly. He died in November 1918, and he left behind him a staggering volume of work, of plays, short stories, what might be termed long short stories, and various other writings. He died quite young, and we'll hear a little more about that lately, and it really is staggering that he has left such a volume of work behind. Now, there are people who feel that Seamus O'Kelly deserves, his work deserves to be known much better and to be known more widespread, and also to be introduced to a modern audience. And some of these people are here in the studio, and these people as well were very much at the forefront last year in organising events to celebrate the works of Seamus O'Kelly. So we have quite a bit to get through here. We're going to be reading and performing excerpts from his works throughout the programme. But we have two people in here, namely Maria Ní Oirirceú and Val O'Donnell, who were pivotal to bring in Seamus O'Kelly's work to the attention of people last year. They intend to do the same this year as well, and this programme is part of that endeavour. So could I just start by going to you, Maria, and maybe you might give us a potted biography of Seamus O'Kelly, where he came from and the sort of important points in his life, and maybe just touch on how you became interested in him and his work.
Thanks very much, Peter. Seamus O'Kelly was born in Loughrea in 1880. He died after being the victim of an assault in his workplace after the armistice of 1918. He died in the early hours of the morning in Jervis Street Hospital. His funeral was huge. It was bigger than Parnell's, according to the reports in the newspapers at the time. He was a great friend of people like George Russell AE, Thomas McDonough, Constance and Casimir Markovitch, Arthur Griffith, Seamus O'Sullivan, James Stephens, people who were involved in the literary revival and also in the national struggle at the time. He was a journalist, and he was the editor of the Southern Star and the Leinster Leader, two papers which are still in existence today. He lived in Skibbereen at one point, and he lived in Naas, County Kildare. He also lived for a time in Drumcondra on Home Farm Road, and living with him at the time were his nephew and his brother Michael and his sister, and the brother and the nephew were involved in the gun running at Howth, and apparently the guns were smuggled. Some of them ended up in the house, and they were hidden away in the piano and places like that. He lived at Sea Point near Dunleary at the time of his death, and he was sharing accommodation with Estella Solomons and her husband Seamus O'Sullivan, the poet. His portrait was painted by Estella Solomons in 1917, and that's still in existence, and I think it might be on view this year. The Weaver's Grave, a presentation copy of it, a special edition, was illustrated by the great Jack B. Yeats, who he was very friendly with. Micheál MacLemore, who was known at one time as Michael Wilmore, illustrated with some lovely woodcuts his collection of short stories, Waysiders. He was featured in The Geneva Window, which was a huge work by Harry Clarke, illustrating the writers of the time. And there are a number of panels, and Seamus O'Kelly's panel is shared with James Joyce. So he was invalided in 1911 with rheumatic fever, and otherwise he would have taken an active part in 1916 and things like that. So that's it. And how I became interested was pure accident, Peter.
Right.
Pure accident, which I'll talk about later.
Okay, right. But I think that puts him in context for us and give us something to work on. I should have mentioned myself there. You mentioned The Weaver's Grave. That's probably his best known work, and that people who wouldn't know much about him might have heard of The Weaver's Grave. Thanks very much for that, Maria. So now the next person we're going to talk to is Val O'Donnell, who is Val O'Donnell has a number of strings to his bow, if you like. We don't have time to go into them at the moment. Suffice it to say that he's a long-term stalwart member of the Dublin Shakespeare Society, with an interest in people like Joyce and Miles na Gcoipleán and also Seamus O'Kelly. So perhaps, Val, you could sort of give us a kind of an introduction to the range of Seamus O'Kelly's works and to say a bit about the standard and quality, and just talking generally about the works of Seamus O'Kelly.
Thanks very much, Peter. As you touched on yourself there, he is known, Seamus O'Kelly, it's sort of one-hit wonder, I think, for the world today of literature. And The Weaver's Grave is regarded as his finest masterpiece. It is a very fine story indeed. But the tragedy is that he had left a bulk of other writing behind him, and plays as well. And these are virtually unknown to writers or to the public today. I just noticed in a very recent and a very excellent Pocket History of Irish Writers, published about 10 years ago, I think, that Seamus Kelly received just one little brief mention in the context of, I'm just quoting from the book, "Some other writers of fiction who published before the First World War can be summed up fairly briefly. Seamus O'Kelly wrote a melodramatic novel, The Lady of Deer Park, and the story The Weaver's Grave, they're his most lasting contributions." So that's a modern summary of the literary value of Seamus O'Kelly. But in fact, when he died in 1918, he was possibly best known as a dramatist, a very successful playwright with the Abbey Theatre in the first decade of the 20th century. He had, for example, two big hits, which are well worth looking at today, aren't revived very much. The Shuler's Child, his first very big success in 1909, is really about the relative competing rights of natural mothers and foster parents, and the state's role in mediation between these. And really, it's a topic that's even popular today, and before the Guardianship of Infant Acts, I think in the 1960s, it was a very unregulated situation, and Seamus O'Kelly was the first writer that we know of who wrote about this important social issue. That was a great success. And also in 1913, The Bribe was another play which dealt with another topic that is ever, I wouldn't say popular, but certainly you hear in different pockets of society, the question of political corruption.
Sorry, Val, can I just interrupt there? You actually directed a rehearsed reading of that, of The Bribe, for the Dublin Shakespeare.
Thank you for remembering that, Peter.
And I took part. That was my first introduction to Seamus O'Kelly, but it was just a name to me at the time. I didn't know anything more about it.
Thanks for reminding us, Peter, on that. Yes, we enjoyed that very much. And I think we had Nora Owen there in the night.
That's right, she was there.
Who was at it and talked a little bit about that issue. Yeah. But those two plays were highly successful. But they illustrated that Seamus O'Kelly was very much his own man, in the sense that he didn't belong to any literary fashion at the time. He wasn't, although he was very friendly with writers like James Stevens and Arthur Griffith and other A.E., George Russell, he wasn't a member of the literary revival movement.
Right.
And he wrote his own plays, more or less plays of social realism, which were, took its place from Ibsen.
Yeah. One of the things, just to me, Val, I was actually staggered by the range of the writings, and he was very prolific as well, in his writings, that he seemed to go from, something that was comic sort of writing, immediately comic, to something that was quite deep, and somebody's writing, you'd probably describe it as being quasi-religious or sacred nearly.
Yes, exactly. Well, possibly his quite in a range of issues certainly would emerge from his writing, but he's probably most notable as a writer of a series of short stories which I think is some of his finest writing, are in two collections of short stories, Hillsiders and Waysiders. Waysiders published in 1917 and Hillsiders posthumously in 1921. One of the tragedies in relation to appreciation of his writing really is that most of his writing was written actually before the First World War, but wasn't published until after he died, and was published in response, some would say, to his very unique circumstances of his death, and when he became a something of a national martyr, and that stimulated interest in his writing. But some of his finest work, including The Weaver's Grave, wasn't published in 1921, so he had no opportunity to see these works himself in writing, or indeed revise them or look at them in an artistic sense.
Which is a terrible pity, thank you very much indeed for that, Val. And the format of this, the rest of this programme, is that we're going to do readings and performances of some excerpts from the works of Seamus O'Kelly, and for each piece Val will give just a small little introduction to them, put them in context for us, and we'll proceed to perform them. So the first piece coming up is actually the Weaver's Grave, and Val, if you could just give us the slight introduction to it, and then the rest of us around the table here, whoever is involved, we have a number of actors and actresses here who will perform that for us. So Val.
Thanks very much, Peter. Well, The Weaver's Grave is certainly among the most acclaimed of Irish short stories, and been translated into many languages and included in many anthologies of the best story writing in the English language. Mortimer Hare, the weaver, has died, and his widow is anxious that he be buried with the generations of his weaver predecessors in the old graveyard of Clun na Marv, the meadow of the dead. But in an era when reliable official records were scarce or non-existent, people looked to the inherited knowledge of local residents, local ancients, really, who helped to locate the graves of the deceased in graveyards like Clun na Marv. And this short sequence from the start of Micheál Ollehea's great adaptation of the story for the stage, two grave diggers are waiting patiently for word from two local ancients, Kerr Bowes, who's a stone breaker, and Micheál Linsky, who's a nail maker, about the exact location of the weaver's grave.
And that's the question. Where are they to bury the weaver?
Oh, give them a chance. Two old fellas the like of them do be very tricky. And Clun na Marv, remember, is not like another graveyard. 'Tis a puzzle to the world. No plan nor map or register exists.
Likely we'll be here all day.
Whisht, man! They haven't started at all yet. And what have we to complain about?
Through for you. 'Tis a sight tougher on the widow there, having to look at them poking and tapping to see where they'll sink the bones of her husband, old Mortimer Hare, the weaver. Well, Micheál Linsky, and how's the search going on?
Never you mind how's the search going on. That's my business. I'm the only man alive with a certain knowledge of all the grave sites here. Not like the supposed caretaker being an official without records. He has only a profound ignorance of the whole place.
Oh, do you hear that, Amadán Linsky? The impertinence of it. And some of my own people buried here. As if my knowledge of Clun na Marv wasn't 10 times superior to the knowledge of the nailer.
All we want to know is where will we bury the weaver?
That's all we want to know. We can't stay forever.
There's many a better man than you that'll stay here forever.
Oh, them that stays in Clun na Marv, my young fella, have nothing to be ashamed of.
To prove a right to burial in this graveyard, me young chappie, is to have the bond of your pedigree sealed. The weaver had such a right, and the 7 generations before him.
Well, he'll get his rights, if only he'll show us where we are to bury him.
You'll bury him where all belonging to him is buried.
We came with some intention of the kind.
You'll bury him
where you're told to bury him.
You'll bury him where I say. Between these two mounds, Between these two mounds is the grave of old Mortimer Hare, the weaver, and here you'll bury him.
Hold on.
Easy there, no? Easy there.
Easy yourself. What is it you're saying about the spot between these two mounds?
I'm saying that it's the weaver's grave.
What weaver?
Mortimer Hare. There's no other weaver in it.
Was Julia... What about Julia Rafferty?
What Julia Rafferty?
The midwife, God rest her.
How could she be a weaver if she were a midwife?
Not a bone of me knows. But I tell you what I do know, and know rightly, that it's Julia Rafferty is in that place and no weaver at all.
I'm telling you it's the weaver's grave.
No, but I'm telling you it's not.
That I may be as dead as me father, but the weaver was buried here.
A bone of a weaver was never sunk in it as long as weavers was weavers. Full of Rafferty's it is.
Alive with weavers it is.
Oh, heavenly father, was the like ever heard to say that a grave was alive with dead weavers?
It's full of them, full as a tick.
And the clean grave that Mortimer Hare was never done boasting about, dry and sweet and deep and in no way bulging at all. Did you see the burial of his father ever?
I did in troth see the burial of his father 40 years ago, if it's a day.
40 years ago. It's 51 years come the 16th of May. It is well I remember it. And it's well I have occasion to remember it. For it was that day after that again that myself ran away to join the soldiers. Me aunt Hotfoot after me, she to be buying me out the week after. And I, a high-spirited fella, a morby token.
Leave the soldiers out of it and leave your aunt out of it and stick to the weaver's grave. Here in this place was the last weaver buried, and I'll tell you what's more. In a straight line with it is the grave of...
A straight line, indeed. Who but yourself, Michal Linsky, ever heard of a straight line in Clonamarv? No such thing was ever wanted or ever allowed in it.
In a straight, direct line, measured with a rule...
Measured with crooked, stumbling feet, maybe feet half reeling in drink.
Well, can't you listen to me now?
It was always a bad warrant to listen to anything except sense. Yourself ought to be the last man in the world to talk about straight lines. You know, with the sight scattered in your head, with the devilish sparks flying under your eyes.
Don't mind my sparks now, nor my sight neither. For in a straight measured line with the weaver's grave was the grave of the Cassidys.
What Cassidys?
The Cassidys that herded for the O'Shea's.
Which O'Shea's?
O'Shea Rua of Capakelly. Don't you know anyone at all, or is it gone entirely, your memory is...
Capakelly in ya. And who cares a whistle about O'Shea Rua, he or his seed breeding generation? It's a rotten lot of land grabbers they were.
My hand to you on that, striving ever to get their red paws on this bit of grass and that perch of a meadow.
Hungry in themselves even for the cutaway bog.
And Mortimer Hare, a decent weaver, respecting every man's wool.
His forehead pallid with honesty over the yarn and the loom.
If a bit of broad-spoken when he came to the door for a smoke of his pipe.
Well, there won't be a mouthful of clay between himself and O'Shea Rua now. In the end, what did O'Shea Rua get after all his striving?
I tell you that. He got what land suited a blind fiddler.
Enough to pad the crown of his head and tap the sole of his foot. Now you're talking.
And the devil is a word out of him. Now, no more than anyone else, including Amarav. The meadow of the dead.
Oh, it's easy talking to us all about land when we're packed up in our timber boxes.
As the weaver was when he got sprinkled with holy water in that place.
As Julia Rafferty was when they read the prayers over her in that place. She a fine, buxom, cheerful woman in her day, with great skill in her business.
Skill or no skill, I'm telling you, she's not there, wherever she is.
I suppose you want me to take her up in me arms and show her to you.
Well, then indeed, care, I do not. 'Tisn't a very handsome pair you would make at all, and you not able to stand much more hardship than Julia herself.
Something will have to be done. The weaver will have to be buried. I'd say that me Halinski must be right.
Oh, put a spade near that place and I'd brain you.
Touch me with that stick and I'll have your...
Don't touch the poor old fellow. You might hurt him.
He has annoyed me greatly, but for your sake I won't touch him. Since you axe me so nicely, I won't even threaten him. Come on, we'll get to work.
Well, that was our first piece, The Weaver's Grave, and I think it'll give you a sense of the sort of comedy that Seamus O'Kelly was able to get into his writing. We have kind of interspersed, to sort of give you a rest from the pieces, we have a little musical interludes, and we have one coming up now, our first coming up. The first, which may be some connection to the pieces, however tenuous, and the first piece is The Spinning Wheel by Delia Murphy. Well, there you have it, the Spinning Wheel by Delia Murphy. And the connection to the previous piece is, of course, is that we have the weaver and his grave, and you weave with a spinning wheel. Anyway, let's move on. We have enough of that. The next piece that we're going to do is a reading, which is the Grey Lake. And Val, perhaps you might introduce the Grey Lake and put it in context.
Thanks, Peter. Yes, The Grey Lake is a remarkable short story, a novella really, novella length, where the legend of a town lying drowned beneath the Grey Lake. And Loughrea, the author's birthplace, is located beside such a lake, such a Grey Lake. And this legend is told by a Shanachie, in the Shanachie tradition, with a beautiful poetic intensity. Is widely admired as one of Seamus O'Kelly's finest stories. And Peter, yourself, you've agreed, I think, to read part of the story where the boatman storyteller Eamon starts to narrate the legend of the Grey Lake.
Long and long ago, there was a sleepy old town lying snug in the dip of a valley. It was famous for 7 of the purest springs of water that ever sparkled in the earth. They called it the 7 Sisters. Round the springs they built an immense and costly well. Over the well was a great leaden lid of extraordinary weight, and by a certain mechanical device, this lid was closed on the well every evening at sundown. The springs became abnormally active between sundown and sunrise, so that there was always a danger that they might flood the valley and destroy the people. As security against this, the citizens had built the great well with its monster lid, and each evening the lid was locked over the well by means of a secret lock and a secret key. The most famous person in the town of the 7 Sisters was the keeper of the key. He was a man of dignified bearing, important airs, wearing white silk knee breeches, a green swallowtail coat, and a cocked hat. On the sleeve of his coat was embroidered in gold the image of a key and 7 sprays of water. He had great privileges and authority and could condemn or reprieve any sort of criminal, except, of course, a sheep stealer. He lived in a mansion beside the town, and this mansion was almost as famous as the 7 famous springs. People travelled from far places to see it. A flight of green marble steps led to a broad door of oak. On the broad oaken door, he had fashioned one of the most remarkable knockers and the most beautiful doorknob that was ever known to Europe. Both were of beaten gold. The knocker was wrought in the shape of a key. The doorknob was a group of 7 water nymphs. A sensation was created which agitated all Ireland when this work of art was completed by 5 of the foremost goldsmiths in the land. The keeper of the key of the 7 Sisters issued a proclamation declaring that there was a flaw in the rounding of one of the ankles of the group of 7 water nymphs. He had the 5 goldsmiths suddenly arrested and put on trial. "The Gael," said the keeper of the key, "must be pure-blooded in his art. I am of the clan Gael. I shall not allow any half-artist to come to my door, their work on their false pretence, and go unpunished." The goldsmiths protested that their work was the work of artists and flawless as the design. Not another word would they be allowed to speak. Bards and artists, scholars and men skilled in controversy, flocked from all parts to see the doorknob. A terrible controversy ensued. Sides were taken, some for, others against, the ankle of the water nymph. They came to be known as the Ankleites and the Anti-Ankleites. And in that tremendous controversy, the keeper of the key proved the masterly manner of man he was. He had the five goldsmiths convicted for failure as supreme artists, and they were sentenced to banishment from the country. On their way from the shore to the ship that was to bear them away, the cork sprang a sudden leak and they were all drowned. That was the melancholy end of the five chief goldsmiths of Erin. One morning at daybreak, trumpets were blown outside the mansion of the keeper of the key. The gates of a courtyard swung open and out marched an armed guard, men in saffron kilts bearing spears and swords. They formed up before the flight of marble steps. A second fanfare of the trumpets and back swung the great oaken door, disclosing the keeper of the key in his bright silks and cocked hat. Out he would come to the doorstep, no attendants by him, and pulling to the great door by the famous knob, he would descend the marble steps. The guard would take up position, and thus escorted, he would cross the drawbridge of the moat and into the town of the Seven Sisters, marching to the streets to the great well. People would have gathered there even at that early hour, women bearing vessels to secure their supply of the water, which it was said had an especial virtue when taken at the break of day. No mortal was allowed nearer than 50 yards to the well while the keeper proceeded to unlock the lid. His guard would stand about, and with a haughty air he would approach the well alone. The people would see him make some movements, and back would slide the enormous lid. A blow on the trumpets proclaimed that the well was open, and the people would approach it, laughing and chattering, and the keeper of the key would march back to his mansion in the same military order, ascend the steps, push open the great door, and the routine of daily life would ensue. For the closing of the well at sundown, a similar ceremony was observed. The only additional incident was the marching of a crier through the streets, beating great wooden clappers and standing at each street corner calling out in a loud voice, "Hear ye people that the lock is on the Seven Sisters, all's well." So that's an excerpt from The Grey Lake, and we're going to move on now, I think, to the next piece, which is The Lady of Deer Park, and we over to Val again to introduce that for us.
Thanks, Peter. Well, the first of Seamus O'Kelly's two novels was The Lady of Deer Park, published in 1917, the year before he died. The young Paul Jennings has succeeded his father as agent for the declining Heffernan family estate. And in this short piece that Stephen Burke will read for us near the beginning of the book, Paul Jennings is describing the circumstances in which the Lady of Deer Park, Miss Mary Heffernan, came into possession of the estate. And incidentally, the story of this book was featured by RTE in the Book on One last November as part of the centenary celebrations of the author's death.
"I can only distinctly recollect once seeing a male member of the family. He was standing at a window as I passed, and the impression that remains with me is of a nervous-looking gentleman, very florid in the face, and the most round shape I have ever beheld. A round body, a little round paunch, round shoulders, round bird-like eyes, a half-opened round mouth, a round dimple on each cheek, a small round head, and a round bald patch as geometrical as a tonsure, gleaming on his crown over the yellow hair. He was really a prisoner in the house. The law was such the time that if he ventured forth between sunrise and sunset, his round body would be seized upon, and he would be rolled into prison in satisfaction of the family debts. Consequently, a number of very ugly characters constantly hovered around the place, vultures watching their prey. The doors and lower windows of the house were barricaded. The demoralised servants became a heroic bodyguard for their master and sworn devotees of his cellars. One day Mr. William Heffernan got down on his knees in his room before a heavy chest and pulled out a bottom drawer. His round hands rummaged through the chaos of its contents. There were old letters, bills, Christmas cards, checks marked refer to drawer, twine, a hammer, discarded cravats, pill boxes, part of the tusk of an elephant, blessed wax candles, ribbons, camphor, and several silver and bronze military medals conferred on various members of the family for deeds done in campaigns against inferior races in the East. And at the bottom of the drawer, his hand at last closed about what he sought. He drew up an old pistol and a tin box of cartridges. Mr. William Heffernan dusted the pistol, handled it, looked doubtful of it, then rose. He put in a cartridge, cocked the pistol, threw up his window and looked down into the Deer Park lawn. The only living thing there was a tiger cat picking its way along the walk, almost directly under the window. Mr. William Heffernan smiled, put out the pistol with a drop of the hand which expressed decision, took aim, fired. The cat sprang into the air, somersaulted, showing a flash of its white belly, fell back, lay tense in the gravel. Mr. William Heffernan smiled and drew in his round head. "Not so bad," he said. "9 lives in one crack." He was so pleased that he polished the pistol with some of the military ribbons, made a round ball of them, and shied them back to the drawer, his smile cheerful. He put another cartridge in the pistol and laid it beside an envelope on the table. He wheeled an armchair to the fire, seated himself, luxuriously smoked a cigar. When finished, he stretched himself, yawned, went to a mirror, oiled and brushed his hair, dusted his clothes, put on a clean collar, a showy necktie. He lay down on a sofa, drawing the tails of his coat under him so that there should be no unseemly creases, jerked down his waistcoat, felt his necktie, and with the palms of his hands smoothed upwards the crescent eyebrows. He reached out for the pistol, raised it daintily in his hand, his little finger hooked upwards like a very polite lady raising her teacup. The barrel of the pistol shifted about his meagre brow, feeling for the direct centre, for Mr. Heffernan was precise. It stopped at the dent immediately above the nose. There was a pause while his tongue moistened his lips. Then the trigger was pulled. The faithful men servants in the kitchen at the back of the house downstairs were seated about the fire, pewter noggins in their hands, talking about the good old times. The butler, Martin Fox, lay asleep in a settle bed by the wall. The hours passed. The noggins were replenished. The men grew more pensive about the good old days. The butler woke up, yawned, looked about him, rose. He stumbled over a hound stretched asleep on the floor, shuffled out of the kitchen, along the hall, and mounted the staircase. The hand on the banister which helped his upward progress was shaky. He blinked a good deal, swayed now and again. The sleep in the settle had not been altogether a success. The butler belched some wind from his stomach as he opened Mr. William Heffernan's door. His uncertain gaze at last rested on the figure reclining on the sofa. He crossed the room, looked down at his master for some time, made the sign of the cross, and ambled to the open window out of which his body leaned. He saw the tiger cat sneaking into the shrubbery, but beyond the shrubbery he addressed a possible audience lurking behind the trees. "Gentlemen," said the butler, "you may now all go to hell, and may the devil roast you there." He spoke with very great vehemence, spat from his fiery breath, and drew down the window. It was the only public speech he had ever delivered. As he turned back to the room, the white envelope and the dark red mahogany table arrested his attention. He went over, took it up, and read with difficulty, "To my faithful butler Martin Fox, with compliments from William Heffernan." He opened the envelope and drew out a cheque. His rheumy eyes ranged along the document. according to its proclamation, it made payable to him the sum of £500. It was duly signed by William Heffernan. Through the sodden brain of Martin Fox, there shot one superb beam of ravishing joy in the fortune acquired. Lucidity and a dull numbness supervened. He put the cheque in his pocket, shuffled to the sofa again, and swayed over the quiet figure there. "No matter, Mr. William," he said. "If it's no good itself, maybe that's not your fault. Your intentions were good, Mr. William. Your intentions were good." He rose on his toes and heels as he spoke, and suddenly the knowledge that something wet and sticky sopped under his slippers sobered him at a stroke. He turned and trotted to the door. At the door he looked back. Dark, wet marks on the carpet recorded his flight from the sofa. With a little cry, he kicked off the bloody slippers and in his stocking feet ambled down the stairs, whining in a low cry of pain as he went.
Thank you very much for that, Stephen. Beautifully read indeed. So now I think it's time for our second piece of music, which is Miss McDermott from Turlough O'Carlan. So there you had Miss McDermott from Turlough O'Carlan. Right, we're on to our next piece, and Val is going to introduce that. Val, the title I have down for this is Can with Diamond. Perhaps you could put that in context for us.
Right, Peter, just a few more words. It's The Can with the Diamond Notch is a beautifully constructed short novella from Seamus O'Kelly. It tells the story of a wealthy country merchant called Festus Clasby, who meets his match when he encounters an extended family of tinkers on his way home one day. So Steve Curran now will read part of the opening of the story, which paints, I think, an extraordinary vivid pen picture of the merchant Gombean man Festus Clasby.
Festus Clasby. The name stood out in chased white letters from the black background of the signboard. Indeed, the name might be said to spring from the landscape, for this shop jumped from its rural setting with an air of aggression. It was a commercial oasis on a desert of grass. It proclaimed the clash of two civilizations. There were the hills, pitched round it like galleries of some vast amphitheatre, rising tier upon tier to the blue of the sky. There was the yellow road, fantastic in its frolic down to the valley, and at one of its wayward curves was the shop of Festus Clasby, a foreign growth upon the landscape, its one long window crowded with sombre merchandise, its air that of established cobweb respectability. Inside the shop was Festus Clasby himself, like some great masterpiece in its ancient frame. He was the product of the two civilizations, a charioteer who drove the two fiery steeds of Agricola and trade with a hand of authority. He was a man of lands and of shops, his dark face, framed in darker hair and beard, was massive and square. Behind the luxurious growth of hair, the rich blood glowed on the clear skin. His chest had breadth, his limbs were great, showing girth at the hips and power at the calves. His eyes were large and dark, smouldering in soft, velvety tones. The nose was long, the nostrils expressive of a certain animalism. The mouth looked eloquent. His voice was low, of an agreeable, even quality, floating over the boxes and barrels of his shop like a chant. His words never jarred. His views were vaguely comforting, based on accepted conventions expressed in round, soft, lulling platitudes. His manner was serious, his movements deliberate, the great bulk of the shoulders looming up in unconscious but dramatic poses in the curiously uneven lighting of the shop. His hands gave the impression of slowness and a moderate skill. They could make up a parcel on the counter without leaving ugly laps. They could perform a minor surgical operation on a beast in the fields without degenerating to butchery. and they would always be doing something, even if it were only rolling up a ball of twine. His clothes exuded a faint suggestion of cinnamon, nutmeg and caraway seeds. Festus Clasby would have looked the part in any notorious position in life. His shoulders would have carried with dignity the golden chain of office of the mayoralty of a considerable city. He would have looked a perfect chairman of a jury at a coroner's inquest. As the head of a pious guild in a church, he might almost be confused with the figures of the stained glass windows. Marching at the head of a brass band, he would have reconciled one to death. There was no technical trust which men would not have reposed in him, so perfectly was he wrought as a human casket. As it was, Festus Clasby filled the most fatal of all occupations to dignity without losing his tremendous illusion of respectability. The hands which cut the bacon and the tobacco, turned the taps over pint measures, scooped bran and flour into scales, took herrings out of their barrels, rolled up sugar sticks in shreds of paper for children, were hands whose movements the eyes of no saucy customer dared follow with a gleam of suspicion. Not once in a lifetime was that casket tarnished. The nearest he ever went to it was when he brought up very cheaply, as was his custom, a broken man's insurance policy a day after the law made such a practice illegal. There was no haggling at Festus Clasby's counter. There was only conversation, agreeable conversation, about things which Festus Clasby did not sell, such as the weather, the diseases of animals, the results of races and the scandals of the royal families of Europe. These conversations were not hurried or yet protracted. They came to a happy ending at much the same moment as Festus Clasby made the knot on the twine of your parcel. But to stand in the devotional light in front of his counter, wedged in between divisions and subdivisions of his boxes and barrels, and to scent the good scents which exhaled from his shelves, and to get served by Festus Clasby in person, was to feel that you had indeed been served.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Steve. That was lovely. And I think we all have, all of a certain vintage, would have an idea in our head of a festive Festus Clasby. Right, so we'll move on to what will be the last excerpt for this evening, and that's The Matchmaker. So once again, Val, you might introduce that for us.
Thanks, Peter. Well, Seamus O'Kelly's short play, The Matchmakers, was a great hit in the Abbey Theatre when it was presented by the Theatre of Ireland there in 1907. Two rival matchmakers are trying to hoodwink each other by making an arranged marriage between two relatives who have certain physical blemishes, let's say. The girl in question having only one hand, and the male wearing a top coat to conceal his embarrassing bandy legs. Now, it's all very non-PC today, of course, but in 1907, well, PC referred only to a peace commissioner. And in this short extract from the play, a neighbour who has been invited to witness the legal marriage agreement turns out to be a very hostile witness indeed. And the neighbour here will be read by Kate Mulvaney is the character, read by Mary Conlon, and the two conniving matchmakers, Larry Dolan and Tom O'Connor, read by Stephen Curran and Peter yourself, respectively, all of whom, happy to say, are members, long-term members of the Dublin Shakespeare Society, and Mary, in fact, is the current chairperson of it.
And sure, it isn't every day a body can be a witness to a match like this. Your nephew is a great long while looking for a woman.
The one he is getting was worth waiting twice as long for.
That's the truth, anyway.
and anything like the big coat he has on him, I never saw the bit of it.
He has a heavy cold, and so I thought the coat, so I bought the coat for him. A man would need to be minding himself when he's going to turn round and enter the blessed state of matrimony.
Did you hear what happened to the widow Dwyer's mare this morning?
She met with a great mishap here.
Oh, you're a caution for excuses, Sean. Sean has no more a heavy cold in him than I have.
Oh, I'm surprised to hear the like of this from you.
It's only a joke Kate is having. She's fond of a joke.
We're all fond of a joke.
So we are. And maybe some of us too fond of joking. But I'm not joking at all.
Let it all pass. There's no harm done. I was saying about the widow Dwyer's mare.
I'm no joker or joker at all. I'm in dead earnest. Your nephew has no more a heavy cold on him than I have.
Then is it a liar you want to be making me out?
Not at all, Tom. Kate said nothing of the kind. You're making a mistake.
You've put the right word on it, Tom O'Connor. A liar you are, and I'm saying it to your face.
I'm surprised to hear this turn from you, Kate.
You needn't then, Larry.
Greatly surprised.
A nice parcel of liars ye are to bring a poor woman like me up to witness a marriage agreement with a man having a pair of legs under him so bandy that, be the powers, you could drive a coach and a four out between them.
If you talk easy, woman alive.
As easy and as hard as I like. Making a match with a woman that thinks he has a pair of natural legs under him.
Kate.
You ought to be ashamed of yourselves, putting Sean O'Connor into a big coat to hide the legs, and she not knowing a taste about it.
If it went to that, it's neither a sin nor a crime.
It's both a sin and a crime, and a shame. A pair of barefaced impostors.
A nice witness you picked up, Larry Dolan.
A witness. I'd see the pair of you swinging from the gallows before I put my name to that.
Be reasonable now, Kate.
Out of my sight with you.
You needn't be so high and mighty at all over it. The curate himself isn't making any great bones about it.
Isn't he now?
I went to him myself. He says he'll marry them.
Did you tell him about the state of the man's legs?
I did. Plump and plain.
What kind of you to be talking about the state of the man's legs?
I'll show you, and his legs up to the world, and to his wife.
It isn't you we're asking to marry him.
It isn't you or your like, anyway, I'd have making.
Where did you get the news or knowledge? Is it any harm to ask?
If you want to know, 'twas Mrs. Larry Dolan.
Herself?
Yes, herself. Did you concede now that one woman could keep the like of that from another woman?
After I warned her.
You can't trust any woman.
Don't mind the woman, ye. 'Twill be fitter for you watching the men that are for deceiving you.
Whisht, Kate, whisht.
Look here, Tom O'Connor. Do you fancy Larry Dolan is going to let you pawn off your misfortunate nephew on his niece?
For goodness sake, hold your tongue, woman.
I'm only beginning with the tongue. I'll lacerate the pair of you.
What are you driving at now?
I'm driving the matchmakers on before me like I drive a fox out of a hen house.
That'll do now. Sit down, Kate, and don't be annoying yourself. It's all over and done.
Oh, here you are now. The pair of you going to pawn off a bandy-legged, decent man and a woman that hasn't a hand to her body but the one and that her kithog.
What's this you're saying?
Don't listen to her. The woman is daft.
Don't I look like a woman that'd be daft? What I'd say, Tom O'Connor, is gospel. Mary Noonan...
Out with you. Don't listen to her.
Mary Noonan, the creature, has but one hand to her body.
Is this true, Larry Dolan?
Don't be tormenting me.
No, he can't deny it. That's why he has her in the cloak.
You're a scoundrel, Dolan.
Isn't she good enough for him?
I'll have the law over it with you.
Do your best. Didn't you think I was a great fool now to take your bandy-legged nephew?
You're nothing but a mean low man.
Your breed was always bad.
Now we'll hear it. The fat's in the fire.
I think very little of kicking you into the street.
You might be the first one out yourself.
You'd have no more than you're no more than a tinker. A main tinker that'd be going the road and be ready to marry the first woman that'd jump the budget with him.
I knew you'd be into it. That's the way with the like of you always. But you haven't heard all the story yet.
I've enough of your story. There couldn't be luck nor grace where the like of you is.
I want Dotty to hear all the story out.
What is she but a meddlesome old chin whacker?
Tell us the rest of the story if you have it. I want to be out of this house quicker than I came into it.
Well, you can take the shortest road you can find.
So, there you have it. That was the expert from the matchmakers. And that brings us to towards the end of our programme. We have gone through all the pieces. And I think you'll agree that the works of Seamus O'Kelly do deserve to be better known and do deserve to be brought to a modern day audience. I'm just getting a signal there from Maria. I think she has something more that she wants to say to you there. So Maria, go ahead.
Thanks very much, Peter. Just to say that one of Seamus O'Kelly's novels, The Lady of Deer Park, that you heard something from there earlier on, it's available now in the library system. Your colleagues over in the National Broadcaster serialised it last year, and as a result there was a big demand to read it, so that's available if anyone wants to borrow it. Also, another event that's going to be on is in the National Library of Ireland on the actual anniversary of Seamus O'Kelly's death. That's Thursday the 14th of November. It's a lunchtime event, 1 o'clock, and Fiona Griffin will be speaking about Harry Clark's Geneva Window and the panel that illustrates The Weaver's Grave by Seamus O'Kelly. So that's a free event.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Maria. Okay. Right, we've reached the end of the programme. I want to thank everybody for taking part. Thanks very much for reading the excerpts. I want to especially thank George Mulcahy here, who is on sound here all evening and has been the essence of patience and understanding here to get us through this programme. So thanks very much indeed, George. So take it away there with a signature tune. And we'll. Oh boy, can I just say as well, could you keep an ear out for another special edition of Curtain Up, and that's our usual Christmas edition. So till then, all the best. Bye.